As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine and I'm now joined by Seb Stafford-Blaw in the studio. Hi, Seb.
Hi, Joe.
How are you?
I'm doing well. Things have changed. There's a skeleton. Well, it's a robot. It's grass.
You're on the Queen's green grass, of course. The green grass of England.
I sure am.
Yeah, anyway. Yeah. Also on the Queen's green grass, at her pleasure, is Scotsman JJ Bull. Hi there.
Hello.
How are you?
Fine. It's a funny mood in the studio today. Joe's being weird.
Well, what can you do? These things sometimes happen. Now, today, we've got loads to get through, including, of course, the NLD. Everyone's favourite NLD. Also, Manchester United lost to Aston Villa. That was quite funny. Brentford-Liverpool, perhaps the best game of the weekend. We'll discuss that a little later. And, of course, Man City beat Chelsea too, as well as other football games which did happen. And I believe that there might be a little word later from my two co-hosts here about the new big football video games that are being released later this week. So hold on to your hats for that one. But if you want to hold on to your hat on a daily basis, then you should get The Athletic. Because every time I read The Athletic, my hat literally comes off based on my surprise and amazement at the quality of the writing available. Visit theathletic.com/TIFO if you're a fan of any Premier League team or indeed five teams from the Championship. Or if you like a Liga, Serie A, La Liga, the other one, Bundesliga. Yeah, there's everyone covering everything all the time. And tell you what, for something with such high volume, the quality extraordinarily high, isn't it, Seb?
Sure is. I've been enjoying Joe Durso's work, especially lately. Really, really good stuff.
The Dursmeister. Yeah, JJ?
Exactly that.
Oh, man. He's the best. Anyway, in fact, read Joey if you want to learn anything about crypto or any of these new coin, you know? That's theathletic.com/TIFO. It's a 30-day free trial, I think. Anyway, that's all for the introduction, and now we will get to the warm hands and the cool embrace of JJ Bull and a travelling abroad Seb Stafford-Blaw. Ah, where else to begin? But of course, the NLD, everyone's favourite NLD, the North London Derby between Arsenal and Spurs. It took place at the Emirates, and it was an embarrassing affair, pretty much, Seb, I would have to say.
Sure was. I was full of dread anyway, because the last time I got on a plane midway through a game, it was Tottenham West Ham last year, you remember, and they were 3-0 up.
We were all having
having a nice time on WhatsApp and joking about it. Got on the plane, took my flight, arrived, refreshed my life score, and 3-0 became 3-3. Wasn't so bad this time because I knew it was going to go badly.
Sure.
But I got off the plane and had a very poor experience at customs whilst kind of digesting the Twitter feed and reacting to what people were saying about it. And yeah, I've since watched the game, an embarrassing, humiliating, completely unacceptable, inept, shit show. It's just, I'm not sure what's worse. that it's also predictable in its tone, or that it's, I don't know, someone interrupt me before I swear and Don has well, to do too much editing.
Let me interrupt you here. Let me ask you something, JJ. Because I watched the game. I suppose, as Seb says, I wasn't hugely surprised. I was quite surprised by how well Arsenal played, and we'll come on to talk about them shortly. But after the game, I was reading a tweet by Jack, one of the Spurs writers, and he said, you know, everyone thought when Nuno arrived, everyone knew he wasn't going to bring attacking football with him. But the sort of upside, you know, the balance there was that he would bring solidity, that he'd make them hard to break down, hard to play against, that they'd make them, you know, be difficult to concede goals. They've conceded 3 goals in the last 3 games now. You're not getting any of what you thought maybe the upside of Nuno would be. How do you explain that?
I think he's a very medium manager, and he will achieve exactly medium. I mean, he've left Wolves in a state where they were kind of fine.
Yeah.
Nothing really spectacular is going on. He hasn't won anything in his career so far. I think he won the championship with Wolves, but that was a team that was good enough to finish basically 7th the next year with amazing players that he brought in. He is meant to be quite similar to Jose Mourinho in his approach. He played under him at Porto as a goalkeeper, mostly on the bench, but I think he even scored a goal.
Yeah.
He did. Yeah, That's a good little fact about Espirito Santo. Mm. They don't do anything. There's no... Like the plan
is an
here,
absence of thing.
Yeah, it's just very nothing. And you can say what you want about, like, he was maybe not their first choice. He didn't seem to really want Spurs to be his first choice when he went there in the first place. Dilly dallied around taking the job and he's offered it. Went in there 3 days before preseason started. He would still have had time to put together a plan and make sure that they've got the training schedules ready to be able to play how he wants to. He's meant to be very into sports science. Where Mourinho wasn't, he is. And so rather than relying on asking a player whether he feels all right, he looks at data to work it out. So in theory, make them a lot fitter, run harder.
Yeah.
But the team, I mean, this is the other problem. Like, he's not really brought in any players, has he? And that's the thing. It's just the same Spurs team that was kind of medium before.
Brian Hill?
I think one of the frustrations on Sunday was that all the players Tottenham brought in over the summer on the bench. And some of them would have started and made, had they started, would have made the team better. Romero is a better defender than, for my money, Eric Dyer.
Why is Eric Dyer still playing? I don't understand.
Well, I think Dyer had a good start to the season, but that shouldn't obscure the fact that Dyer's quite a limited centre-half. Hill, when you've seen him, this might be a fitness thing, because Nuno has said it over the past few weeks, we've got different players who are at different stages of conditioning, so we're having to manage that, fair enough. But every time Hill has played, he's brought a level of creativity which this side desperately, desperately lacks. And I think, I don't know, I mean, try this on for size. To me, when you watch this team, it's full of players who don't want to play in this way. It's obviously not going to be that simple, but there's a resentment to the style. I always think back to that moment in the Amazon documentary when Dele Alli came in at halftime from some game that they were losing, and he was complaining about, oh, we're just booting the ball and defending it. And to me, a lot of these players are still holdovers from the Pochettino era, who did not thrive under Jose Mourinho, and who have the same sort of weariness towards the kind of the imposed style now that they did before. And it's very difficult to accept. It feels like, on the one hand, you could make an argument for Nuno by saying, well, he's inherited a group of players who don't suit him. But then the counter to that is to say, well, you gave him a 2-year contract. So obviously you're not going to, in the space of 24 months, you're not going to reconstruct a squad with hundreds and hundreds of millions of pounds to suit this guy. So what's the aim here?
Well, and it seems a lot like they brought Nuno in to try and not stabilise things, but they didn't have a manager.
I think they got to a stage where the managerial search became increasingly embarrassing, rightly so, because it was so poorly handled. And then they arrived at a situation where we need someone to do this. We need someone to sit in this office.
Unless Daniel Levy's literally going to...
Yeah, because otherwise, where are we going to go? And so it became a, right, just get this guy. He's free. He's not attached. He'd left Wolves. There's no expense involved. There's an element of saying he's being overpromoted because he probably hasn't quite... He did good things at Wolves. Probably hadn't earned the right to go to that level of the game.
Do you think they thought there was some consistency with what came before from Mourinho too because of a similar style of football, approach?
Possibly, but then after Mourinho was sacked, Daniel Levy released a statement saying, we are going to return to traditional club values. He actually mentioned attacking football. And he sort of, I don't know, that's kind of been forgotten. It's very, very strange. Sure. And it doesn't, there's no part of this process which can survive any sort of scrutiny.
Well, let me ask you this then, because, and for fear of people calling us dramatic, I'm sure this will happen. Only six games into the season, of course, three wins and three losses so far. It feels that there are very few things to point towards for being positive in Nuno's favour. And given that we know that he was the, you know, quite far down the list in terms of the head coaches that were touted for the Spurs role, how soon is too soon to just cut your losses? Because it feels a bit like, I mean, put it this way, the players know that he was far from the first choice. The players know that Daniel Levy said they wanted to play more attacking football. The more I learn about football, the more I learn about how things actually work, the more I imagine that Daniel Levy saying that probably came from some conversation with the players wanting to do that too, right? Or at least making themselves known. Yeah. How soon is too soon to just cut
the
losses?
No such thing is too soon, because...
Would you do it now?
Yes, I think so, because I think there's a virtue in recognising that a mistake has been made. I understand that that's not what will happen, because if you sack a manager now, it looks like the club's fault. If you sack a manager in 6 months' time when the club is 14th out of all the cups and struggling in Europe, then that's about him. If you dismiss him on the back of a North London derby defeat, bad as it was, you look very reactionary. But I'm not saying that that's what should happen. I just think that's what I would be inclined to do, because I don't have any, as a fan, and this is not me looking at it in sort of any analytical way or, you know, with any data or whatever, but I'm not interested in what happens next. It's not that I don't care. I care very, very deeply about what happens to the club, but I'm not interested in where this is going, because the thing about patience, and this always gets banded about, when a manager is struggling, people say, oh, just give him time. It's the kind of default response. Whereas in reality, no, patience is earned, because you can accept flaws. You can look at a team and think, well, they've lost that game, but they did this, this, and this quite well. And, you know, in 6 months, maybe this little dynamic that's being constructed, maybe that will work a little bit better. There's nothing here that interests me. And I think Nuno Espirito Santo is a fine coach for a certain type of club at a certain level. I don't think this is right for him. I don't think it's right for Spurs. And there's got to be a merit in recognizing that now, rather than saying, well, let's give it another 6 months and see what happens then. Because I feel like...
He looked embarrassed on the sidelines.
But I think he should be, Joe. Like, I don't think that's... I don't want to be one of those... I don't want to be one of those... I don't want to be one of those pride and passion guys.
Oh, you can't help that.
But as a fan, that's nowhere near acceptable in a derby. It's actually, I was saying to JJ, who came in, haven't seen you guys for quite a while. One of the conversations JJ and Hyatt had was, when I watched, I've only watched, I suppose, about 65 minutes of it now. But it's not that you see Tottenham making mistakes, although there are mistakes in the play. It's not that there are, you know, there's missed tackles and this missed interception. It's just everywhere, in all the three goals that Tottenham conceded against Arsenal, it's bafflingly bad. It's almost, it's not, you know, oh, I could see what the strategy was there. It was just, well, there doesn't seem to be a strategy. It's a, let's collapse back and try in half. Let's not contest 50-50 balls. Let's run less than the opposition and let's see where that gets us. And the answer to that is 3-0 down at half time against a team. I don't want to sound sour. I know this is how it will come across, but Arsenal played well.
Yeah, they played well. Yeah.
But I'm also, and it hurts me to say this, they only play well against Tottenham, and Tottenham are not a measuring stick anymore, really. This Tottenham is just it's a nothing. And it made that Arsenal team look like the Invincibles, in the first half at least. Strangely enough, like in the second half, Tottenham probably could have scored three goals, which is a very weird thing to say, but I think that was partly, that's game state, really, rather than kind of anything that Tottenham did particularly well.
Yes.
And I feel humiliated by it. And you can't forgive that easily. Like, I would say that if Nuno Espirito Santo is in a situation where he doesn't have to restore Spurs to what Pochettino created immediately, but immediately he does have to show that there is a point to this. Whatever that may be, just doesn't have to be a comprehensive 5-0 win. It just has to be something which people can go, okay, I'm willing to persevere with that. That's piqued my interest, but there's none of that at the moment. Rant over.
JJ, another thing about Spurs which looks bad this year is, and again, this might sound a little sensational after six games, but spending the entire summer refusing to sell Harry Kane to Manchester City for many, many millions of pounds doesn't look like the best idea now, does it?
No, and you should learn that from playing Football Manager when your players just don't play as well as they're supposed to when they want to leave.
Yeah,
I don't think that's why he's playing badly. I think he's just having a bit of a bad time because they're not creating anything really.
Sure.
And
I think it's 50-50. Like, I agree with you. Like, the system isn't designed to suit him. I think some of his performances have been wholly unacceptable.
Let's make it clear, though, right? That, and not for the sake of... I'm not trying to defend Harry Kane specifically, but I think it would be good to make the point that you don't mean intentionally. You just thing happens when you're disappointed. It happens to me all the time. I'm disappointed, and then I don't perform to my maximum because I can't, because there's something wrong with my head.
Yeah, well, we've all been there, but I don't think it's necessarily that. I think it's this is a legacy of a truncated preseason. Mm. He did not arrive back on time. We're still unsure about why or what the dynamics of that situation exactly were, but he looks like a player who isn't fit, who isn't conditioned properly.
I sort of thought that for the last 2 years, though.
He does have that, but in the past, when he's been, for instance, when he's recovered from a long-term injury, which he's had to do quite a few times now, you have that spell of games, usually last maybe 2 or 3 months, where he's absolutely rubbish and his touch looks awful, but he still scores goals.
Yeah.
And he still provides a kind of a baseline contribution. Now, there is a coaching problem there too, because the system doesn't suit him, clearly. His touch is wrong. If you look at the... I think it was the Saka goal. I think I'm right in saying when he miscontrolled the ball on the edge of the Arsenal box, fell over, ran back,
then he went for tackle.
Back, tried to make the tackle.
He
and
got
just
in,
provided
the worst
assist.
Thing is, I think he got in the way of the defenders.
Yes,
too.
He did. Yeah, he did. He kind of
extra bad.
He's trying to do everything at once because he thinks he's the best player.
But
and he's making himself worse by doing it.
I feel that's a symptom of something else as well. When you do that, it's not really about you. It's about how you look at what's around you and how much trust you have. There's no way Kane does that when Pochettino is manager, because you trust the system. You trust Dembele back there, Wanyama back there, Vertonghen and Alderweireld. You don't go charging 80 yards because at the very least, it's not a thoughtful passage of play, because you are removing your own side's outball, even the big lump upfield into one of the channels. You are inviting a further phase of pressure in 30 seconds time.
So he wants to be a top tier player. He wants to be playing at Juventus or Bayern Munich or Manchester City or someone who competes for things, and he's in a team that has underperformed, or actually he's probably peaked ages ago and was never good enough to really get to where he wants to be in the first place. They just overperformed constantly, Spurs, and now they've kind of regressed to where they roughly were, and often the reason they were overperforming is because Kane was scoring way over his XG. And so that was a thing, and now he wants to get out.
But the overperforming thing's really interesting though, JJ, because I look at two halves of the Pochettino era. Like the first half, I don't think they did overperform. I think they were probably the second or third best team in the country for a period of maybe 2 years, 2.5 years. I think they then, during the what we'll call the Sissoko as the entire midfield era, that was a strange time where funny things happened. Like obviously the peak of that is Amsterdam and that comeback and the Champions League final, all those kind of things. But somehow they got to where they needed to be. And a lot of that was to do with sometimes his goals, but he was also missing for long periods of that time. Like he was injured consistently. He was out of form. And I mean, in many ways, actually, probably Son Heung-min allowed them to compete above where they deserve to be.
That is true.
He and Kane were both, they're both top tier players. They could play for Real Madrid probably.
Yeah. And Son especially, I would say. Like Son deserves better.
Sure. And this is the thing with Spurs for me. So I disagree that I think they did overperform. And you look at things like, I remember going through expected goals and all that sort of bits before and other articles I've written in the past. And I always thought Spurs weren't actually that good. I never really thought, I think Pochettino was clearly a high quality coach, but I don't think he's this mastermind that he got labelled as. And I think Spurs, had they not had the fortune of having Son Heung-min and Harry Kane exactly the right time when they're really, really at their best, they would be nowhere near that.
It's kind of
a stupid thing to say. Like, if you've got the best players, obviously you can do better. But without those two, they just weren't that good. And that squad needed to be broken up ages ago. Eric Dier, I'm sure, is a great person to have around the squad. and is a very useful squad player. But he is not the player he was when he was younger. He's not there. That cannot be the level that you want for a team that's trying to push for top four. They should have let people like Alderweireld and Vertonghen go where they wanted to. Should have let Eriksen go when they wanted to. It's all, I understand the business side of it from Levy's point of view. Don't want to be looking like a selling club because it devalues you and kind of makes you not have the value of the club that you should have, and the kind of thing if you want to be where Harry Kane is. Kane wants him to be top four and to be the guy who can make that happen, like Shearer did at Newcastle back in the day. And then he signed that contract, which is way too long, and it was a silly decision based on how good it was going at the time. And now they're just kind of where they, I mean, Spurs are where they should be. They're an upper mid-table team. They're not good enough to be top four.
Yeah,
and that's kind of what they've been for ages, but just that they had Kane and Son absolutely smashing in goals for ages, and that's why they were so good.
Well, speaking of upper mid-table teams, let's discuss Arsenal. And I've written here, Arsenal, Seb, Arsenal were fast and accurate and strong. They're also smart in their game management. This is what I liked about Arsenal's game. They pressed extremely high off the bat. They clearly came out as the sort of faster and better team. They scored that fantastic early goal, but then they changed things up. And their second two goals, both of them mostly came from counterattacks. And I thought that the way that they managed the game throughout the phases, even in the last 20 minutes when Spurs obviously got one goal back and Arsenal was sat off, they didn't panic. They kept it sort of shut down. They did exactly what they needed to do to win the game. It was maybe the most mature Arsenal performance I've seen under Arteta. And, you know, that is sort of highlighted by the fact that they play a lot of young players in that team.
Yeah, the counter-attacking thing was interesting because those sweeping moves recall like a different era of Arsenal football. There was so much pace and so much accuracy. Like, you can talk about, oh yeah, well, you know, Tottenham weren't doing this or this, fine, sure, but you also need to play that precisely to counterattack so effectively. And actually Arsenal were more logical in this game than I've seen them for ages. Like, I thought that they were aimed at, clearly they identified Dyer and Sanchez as a combination that could be pressed and were pressed very, very effectively. Spurs looked vulnerable every time they took the ball out of defence. To me, actually, it's one of Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang's best performances for Arsenal. Like, I'm sure there's Arsenal fans who know better, but I can't remember thinking, certainly not for a long time, seeing him being quite so involved. Compare him to Harry Kane's performance, for instance. And usually, like, typically over the last few years in this game, it's been the other way around. Like, Kane has been the one which Aubameyang has been measured against and pilloried as a result of, you know, the kind of disparity in contribution. But yeah, no, really, really impressed. I thought the defence was good. I thought Ben White played very well. I thought Tomiyasu was great at fullback. He had a little bit of a bad moment in the second half when, you remember when Kane, the ball got dropped over the top for Harry Kane and he just pushed the ball wide. That, like, but you know, other than that, he's had a really, really good start to his Arsenal career. And it's strange because he's not the profile of fullback that you associate with Arsenal. Like, he's very, very different from a kind of a Hector Bellerin, for instance, or a Lahren, or a, you know, those kind of players. But he's been impressed, and I think Aaron Ramsdale's done very well, which says something about him, because think about the conversation that surrounded Aaron Ramsdale for most of the summer. Like, he was laughed at. Like, he didn't have the best season at Sheffield United last year. And Arsenal's protracted pursuit of him became a kind of a stick with which I would have to go back, but I'm pretty sure we laughed at it because it didn't make a lot of sense this time. So this guy's,
well, it's because the figures were all quoted at £30 million. I don't know if that's what they paid in the end, but yeah, that was the figure for a while.
If you put yourself in his situation, Joe, like, you come into a club and you are you have this big fear around your neck. You are charged with replacing Bernd Leno, who, whatever you may say about him, has played international football for Germany, must be a pretty good player.
Sure,
and
sure.
And was a very, you know, quite a high profile, expensive signing in his own time. Come in and he's played really well. He made some excellent saves. That save from Lucas Moura towards the end of yesterday's game was just was fantastic. And so, like, that's a good news story. And it feels like all of a sudden, all these things that were typically bad about Arsenal, central defence, goalkeeper, fullback, Aubameyang's contribution at the top of the pitch, all of a sudden they started to become slightly more positive. I'm still a bit on the fence about Arsenal. Like, I just beating Spurs, it's just not a big deal.
Spurs were garbage. I don't even think Arsenal were that good, honestly. I think they just did the things.
Oh, no, they were pretty good.
Yeah, but they're good because they could be like, this is the stuff Arteta's trying to be doing with them for ages, and it seemed really easy to do it against Spurs.
I just haven't seen it before, JJ. Like, I think you'll probably end up being right. It's just that I haven't seen them playing quite so slickly under Arteta.
Yeah, I don't agree. I thought they were good. I know what you mean about the opposition sort of not being there.
I just don't think they were amazing. I think they were good, but they should be because they have good players. I know they had all these players in the right positions for maybe for the first time. I thought Tomiyasu was their best player. I really like.
Yeah, he's great. He's really good.
And
player.
He's the kind of character they seem to need. He seems a bit mad. I like that. Like running about and just look really like focused on the game and like that. I think that's perfect for what they needed. To help with what they're trying to do. I mean, Partey back is an important player for them. He makes a big difference in how they manage midfield.
Tomiyasu, do you remember when he signed? He was mocked on Sky Sports News as well. There was some talking head conversation going on where they were like laughing at the fact that, oh yeah, some guy from, you know, Serie A. It's like, well, does he deserve that? He's had a pretty good career in Serie A. He's built a name for himself, come in and immediately defeated that negativity. It's not quite the same as the Ramsdale situation, but it's another little example of it where you arrive as, you know, to an unknown to many English football fans, and you already have this sort of negative context surrounding you. It's difficult for a player, and he's done very, very well.
Yeah. I just think I would go a little easy on proclaiming Arsenal to suddenly be amazing, Arteta's finally got it all right, or everything like that.
Oh yeah, no one's doing that.
I'm not saying that's what you're saying, but I read it online.
Okay. What I'm saying though is that I haven't seen them play as well as that.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
So not that they were amazing, just that in comparison to the performances I've seen that team put in so far this season, this was very good.
I think what often happens is they play against a team who it feels like they work harder than them and are strong defensively. I mean, like Brentford, were better than them when they played them.
Mm-hmm. Brighton up next as well. That's really interesting.
Yeah,
I
really
want
to see that game.
Because that's a really well-coached team who can press high if they want, or they can drop back and let them come out to them. There's a thing that Michael Cox wrote a piece on Arsenal Spurs in The Athletic.
Mm.
And he was pointing out how one of the things Arteta did when he first took over.
My hat's fallen off.
Oh, that's good. It's stuck up into the roof.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, from earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in that hat has fallen magic.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say in that hat has fallen Michael Cox's words.
Yes, that's what I meant. The magic was what Michael Cox wrote.
Oh.
Yes. What was I saying? Something about Arteta. Oh, yeah. One of the things Arteta did when he started was that he tried, rather than press high, he would try and like, engage a little bit later so the other opposition team would open up a bit so there's room to attack. That's what they did. And then he sort of abandoned it because nothing really worked at the start. And then he went through all the different formations and shapes and systems. And now he's got it, by Jove, helped by Spurs being absolutely rubbish. Like, there's the thing, they didn't work hard, really. They didn't have any midfield.
That was really weird. We were texting about that, weren't we?
Yes.
Because for the first 30 minutes, it looked an awful lot like Højbjerg was part of the defence. And Ndombele was part of the attack. And they were like in a line. Do you remember when we had the football manager, the first football manager face off, you and I? And I played with that kind of arrow formation pointing towards my own goal. That was this. That's what this looked like.
Yeah, it didn't
work.
It
was weird.
It was weird.
Because they were always just like lumping it long from defence. So presumably they think they don't need a midfield.
Maybe. I mean, it was a. They started. I think the game plan was to try and keep things quiet at the start and try and reduce any chances for Arsenal.
Good job.
Yeah, exactly. Well, exactly. It didn't work.
Do you find that quite strange in itself? Like, if that's your game plan when you go to, oh, I don't know, Anfield, Old Trafford, the Etihad, okay.
But you're facing sounds like he does know.
But you're facing a team that is playing better, but still a little bit fragile because there's still some doubt. As we've all said, we haven't seen them play like this before. So your game plan in North London Derby is to go there and see how good they can be. That just is so counterintuitive.
That's what Nuno does. He's very reactive as a coach. So he'll often wait. So most of Wolves' goals when he was there, I can't remember the number, but it's almost double the amount of goals were scored in the second half to the first.
I understand. I know people say a lot of negative things about it. I quite enjoyed watching Wolves at Molineux. They were not entertaining, but they were nice, sort of pleasing aspects of their football. But it's different. Like at Wolves, you have a group of players who have strengths in certain areas. at Spurs, you have Son, you have Kane, you have Ndombele, you have Ali, and you're playing in a way which kind of takes the emphasis away from all of those players' strengths. Okay, maybe there's a little bit of a counter-attacking emphasis which suits Son. I understand that, but I'm not having Son as a kind of a one-trick counter-attacking player. Like, Son's a very complete footballer. He can do things on the front foot, you know, counter-attacking, everything. And yet, it's quite stubborn to think, well, this worked for me at Wolves, you know, when I was in the Championship and the kind of the middle of the Premier League. Now I've come to a club which is different in size and status and has a slightly different kind of personality of squad to it. And I'm going to play in exactly the same way.
I've grown tired of this. Okay. Let's go to a break.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
We're back from the break. And the next up is Man United 0-1 Aston Villa. Now, JJ, this was a funny game. But the funniest bit was it Jonathan Pearce? Was he the commentator? That's a commentator. That's his name, isn't it?
Jonathan the name Pearce? Of a commentator. Yes.
Jonathan Pearce. He was irate. He couldn't believe it when the corner goal happened because there was no man on the post. And he was irate. He was furious. Did you hear him?
I did.
Furious.
He hates things that change from the past.
Couldn't believe that there was no man on the post. Irate. Anyway, irate your ability to explain to us now why that is the case. Because it's not like just a completely stupid thing, is it? It is for a reason, as with most things that happen in football that are planned.
Yeah.
It's for a reason.
Yeah.
And just because something, air quotes, you know, works for 40 years, why should we change it now?
He said, if it worked for generations, why wouldn't it work now?
Well, you know, I used to wash in a bath of beans.
Oh, I thought about it on my horse ride to work this morning.
Yes. Yeah. That's better, isn't it? The beans thing didn't make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense.
That didn't happen in the past. Anyway, why don't you always have someone on the post now at corners? Because that's how Aston Villa scored their goal.
Yeah, well, they scored because the ball went into the little slot in the left side of the goal where you think a man could be standing there to prevent that from happening.
Yeah,
Paul Pogba, his zonal job in that set piece was to defend. What a lot of teams do, and this is what Paul Pogba was doing, is they will stand level with the near post, but on the 6-yard line.
Mm.
Some of them take a step behind, so they're closer to the goal. So they're sort of watching that near post zone because you think the most valuable areas people are most likely to score from is running across the near post to get a header from there,
yeah,
or someone attacking a penalty spot. I think it would be the most valuable bits of a corner to get the ball towards.
Mm.
So most good teams, in fact, we did this at Euros, we did a video on the internet, and at the Euros, all these teams, I think there was one team, maybe Sweden, I think it might have been, that put a man on the posts at any time. Everyone else didn't do it.
Yes.
I think some of these international managers might have more of an idea about why that's a good idea than the Robot Wars commentator. Maybe. As good a commentator as he is, and I like his voice.
Does he commentate Robot Wars?
Yeah, do you remember that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I thought that was...
It's Chaos 2!
I thought that was...
Here comes Megatron to stamp on the... Metallic centipede.
If they'd allow robots from Red Dwarf, you could stand on things, called? That would be not good.
Craig Charles.
Yeah. Yeah,
I thought that was Craig Charles.
Yeah, he hosted it.
He presented.
Oh, he hosted it.
Jonathan Pearce.
Oh, you're right. He was the commentator on Takeshi's Castle, wasn't he?
Yes.
Yeah.
And Jonathan Pearce was amazing at Robot Wars. He made it really good.
Now you say it.
Yeah.
I can, yeah.
I
Zelda coming in with the claw!
I always think about the Phoenix Knights sketch. For Robot Wars with like Ray Vaughan and Max and Paddy and the you know, look it up.
Yeah. Little insight there.
Chaos 2 is my favorite.
Chaos, do you have a favorite robot from Robot Wars?
Yeah, yeah, Chaos 2. I also liked a one called Razor.
That brackets you as a particular type of person.
What was the flipper, the one that flipped?
Chaos 2, there was a few of them. There's a few of them. One like really a wedge of cheese ones. Was quite good for a while, but I think the meta was
but that
set
show
early
must have been scripted because like
no.
The other ones had like hammers that would come down and hit the top of a robot and like clearly they were never going to do any or enough damage. Whereas another one you could get underneath and flip it upside down. And you win the war immediately.
Aye, but some of them, like Razor, was built like a scorpion, so it had this big tail that would crush. And, and when that worked, it was really good.
That was good.
There was a couple of kind of joke robots. There was one, this Irish team went in and it had all like fur. So when it got set on fire, and I never really understood what the point of that was.
Fun.
I like the ones where like it doesn't work. So people have been slaving away for 2.5 years because they're going on Robot Wars and like... And somebody's forgot to put a battery in the remote, so it just sits there limply while something else just, you know, hands
That's
away.
That's quite funny. That something they spent months on working with their children and something comes along
and actually, they're not working with the children. They're kind of, the children are told to sit in the corner of the garage while they work on it. And it's, you know.
Get more insights from Seb's life.
And they met a change from being flippers to being to spinning disc, hypno disc.
Yeah, hypno disc.
Remember that one?
Yeah.
And I just like hypno disc, Robot Wars. In this set piece routine, I don't know. So what footballers do at corners now is they stand in the 6-yard line level with the near post. If the ball goes over that near post zone, they then fall back. So they're effectively the far post man on the post. That's what they do.
Yeah.
And the reason that they do this, rather than having two fullbacks on the line, as Jonathan Pierce suggested they should do, is because you've got a choice of between trying to block the final action or preventing that action from happening in the first place.
That's the better one.
I think that's the best one. That's what I would do. And that's why you see a mixture of zonal and man for most teams.
That's why people brush their teeth, you know? So they don't have to have teeth taken out.
Yes, that's why they brush their teeth.
Well, anyway, Fernandez missed a penalty, Seb, and he'll never take one again, will he?
Been quite a lot of commentary on his apology essay. It's got a strange facet.
It's weird.
But I think it's quite understandable. I don't think it's really about modern players. It's about modern fans' inability to accept that occasionally things in football matches don't happen in the way that they want them to. And it's a way for a player or a player's representative to kind of head that.
Can we just think that through for a minute, though? Because,
Okay.
Anyone reading that isn't going to be probably the kind of person that would be furious at him for not doing it. And B, the kind of person who would be furious at him for it is not the kind of person who will then go, oh, but he apologised.
No,
so it's fine.
I disagree, Joe.
It's fine.
I think.
Am I missing a whole kind of person?
I think so. So it happened twice last week, actually. Marvellous Nakamba did something very similar after he missed in the shootout at Stamford Bridge for Villa in the League Cup. And I feel like it's aimed at the type of fan that kind of lives through the social media cycle, that is very susceptible to the tiny little things which kind of dictate their mood, be it a missed penalty or slightly underwhelming performance or a nice looking holiday photo from a player. They're like, I think it's actually, it's smart is the wrong word, but I think it's more astute than it looks.
Savvy
is the right word. Yeah, I feel like there's an agent out there who said, guys, this is our game plan when these little things happen, because it's like, okay, well, you know, to someone, Bruno missed a penalty, but Bruno cares. Bruno really cares. He wants to know whether I... Like, it's aimed at a slightly naive...
Who are these people?
Children?
Right, children.
Yeah, I think it's aimed at a younger type of fan. Yeah, for sure. Like, I think it's very sad that we've arrived at this point, that you have to then... Because this is how it works.
Can I say, actually, on a serious note, players never used to do this, right?
Of course.
And if it works for generations, why change it now?
Do you know who never apologized? Hypnodisc.
Hypnodisc.
Well, you know what's actually going to be bad about this is the reverse. So the first player that misses a penalty in that situation and doesn't write the apology essay is going to get hammered.
Mm.
Absolutely hammered. Doesn't care.
I'll praise that player.
You know, so it's complicated, but it's quite weird. Also, what do we make of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's comments? We talked about Bruno being... Well, so the penalty gets awarded and he was upset because Bruno had his space crowded by Villa players.
Penalty. And then he said, I wasn't going to bring it up, but you did. So
this has got to stop.
Speak to
him. It's got to stop.
He's just doing the Fergie template of blaming things and deflecting.
If you look at Alex Ferguson's coaching tree of managers. There's an awful lot of players on there, awful lot of ex-players on there who became coaches who did a lot of excuses, who made a lot of excuses, who spent a lot of time talking about officials. And it feels as if none of them really recognized that what allowed Ferguson to do that was coaching tree.
This is my coaching tree.
But that's just a normal tree.
It's tended to.
Do you think you could beat Hypnodisc?
By Jack.
Like if it was you against it in the ring?
I think so. What do you think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer would say about Hypnodisc?
I think he would deflect the...
clumsily. You'd
bit like Hypnodisc.
Yeah.
I'm with you, man. But I didn't really listen to what you were saying. Let me ask you this question, though. One quick note here on Manchester United before we talk a little bit about Aston Villa. Ronaldo and Greenwood in this game, they sort of seemed to get in each other's way a little bit, and I didn't think it was that good. And what I would like to say though is I thought it was quite nice to see Greenwood just shooting anyway. And he seems to be the only player on the team that doesn't immediately pass the ball to Cristiano Ronaldo, JJ, and I like it.
I've not noticed this. I think they were.
It's probably because it's not real. I'm just thinking it, so I'm saying it.
And
out loud.
They were mostly trying to break against Villa, who were really good in that game, and they were just trying to get. I mean, I think Villa defended a couple of those.
Will you tell me what Villa did well then instead?
They defended well. They
attacked well.
Yeah, they changed their shape, didn't they? Like a 3-5-2. I think they changed it too. So they had Watkins and who's the other chap up front? Oh, Ings. Yes. It's a good two. And then we knew Dean Smith was going to try and do this season. Something he wanted to try and do is play a front two, which you can mostly do by getting the back three in. You've got your width, just like Chelsea play, basically.
Mm.
And it tends to be the weaker side, if you will, would do this because it means they've got more defensive solidity. They can block the middle of the pitch.
Sure.
And you know what? United are really good in transition normally, getting better at being able to break down teams.
I know we were in work on Saturday because we were watching the Chelsea-Manchester City game, which took place at the same time. But I was sat next to Athletic news desk team member, Holly Percival, who was half watching the Aston Villa-United game as a Villa fan and half working. And based on the noises that she made throughout the game, Villa had a great number of chances that they could have finished but didn't. So the scoreline could have been worse than it was, Seb.
Yeah, it felt a little bit like the game Villa played at Chelsea, where they played really, really well and then lost 3-0.
Yeah.
And it was kind of necessary because the knock on Villa then is, well, you know, you can play well at a ground like that, but you can't win. So for so quickly afterwards to go to a ground again, play really, really well. And I imagine Holly, as well as every other Villa fan watching, was just waiting for the kind of the penalty or the kick in the teeth or the sort of the repeat of what happened. You go and do that and you go and win the game and you go and have a little bit of luck at the end with a missed penalty. And all of a sudden your season can change a little bit and your perception of yourself can change a little bit. And Villa are an interesting team. And when something like this happens, when you win away from home at Old Trafford against a team full of the kind of players that Solskjaer has, that's very, very powerful. You'd think so, wouldn't you? It'd be kind of thing where it emboldens you. Next time you step out of the Etihad, you think, well, yeah, but we're not just here for the day out on the Instagram. Like, we can actually beat this caliber of team and we shouldn't be afraid of a kind of a Ronaldo level of player. Our defence can stand up to those sorts. And that's it's great because I think Dean Smith's done an amazing job at Villa, actually.
Sure.
It's really, really, really impressive.
They've got 8th place right now, 10 points after 6 games. It's been a pretty good start for a team that lost their best player.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been exciting to see some of those new additions warm into the side. They've got a bit of a tough run in October, though. They're away to Tottenham, Wolves at home, away to Arsenal, West Ham at home. Not the easiest run, but it'll be interesting to watch them in those games. You would have thought they can get some points out of those.
Yeah, well, I'd expect them to win at Tottenham.
Sure, that goes without saying.
It goes without saying. Yeah. Also, not quite sure at the moment how serious Leon Bailey's injury is, but he gives them a different gear. Like, even he's had cameos so far, and that he sort of, I think he had 21 really good minutes against Everton. All of a sudden, you see a kind of a dynamism to Villa, which any team in the country needs to be afraid of. And so I think the knock on them last season was they could play quite well, but they didn't really have much of a punch. Grealish could do something. Watkins is a pretty good goal scorer. Now you've got a few more match winners. So if Danny Ings has a bad day, then there is a Bailey to do something. It's not all centered around Grealish, and your answer when playing Villa is not, right, take away Grealish and you don't have to worry so much. Make somebody else beat you. All of a sudden, you have to do that for three or four other players. So it's fun, and the league is better for teams like Villa. When you have someone's upwardly mobile and ambitious and adding kind of new strings to their bow, they become one of those teams that you want to watch. It's not just a kind of, Villa are playing this or that. You think, yeah, I want to watch Villa. That's interesting. Let's see how they grow this week.
I want to watch Villa.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Also, I want to watch Brentford. Yeah. Brentford 3-3 Liverpool, JJ. Best game of the weekend.
Yeah, well, lots of goals in it. Mm. Very exciting end-to-end. Could have been even more goals.
You've heard it there. Now, tell me a little bit about Brentford. I know we've covered them a bit on this podcast before, but Seb, I really want to know what you think about them as a team.
Brentford?
Yeah.
Interesting.
I just turned to you. JJ's face made it look like I should not ask him that question.
Well,
so, I turned to you. You're our last hope here. We think Alex is outside. We could ask him to come in. He likes them, doesn't he?
I think what I like about them,
Alex,
is that they haven't... Sometimes when a team gets promoted, they abandon a lot of the things that they did well at a low level.
That's a good point. Isn't that a good point?
You kind of... It's almost like, oh, well, you know, we have to pretend to be something else. We're a Premier League team now. They play in the same way. They rely on a lot of the same things. Their set pieces still clearly have a lot of coaching and training emphasis. I think I've mentioned this last week, but I think the thing I've taken away is probably the subtlety to Ivan Toney's game, because I thought of him as someone who would probably fit into the David Nugent category a little bit when he came into the Premier League. He would sort of be shown for what he was, and that couldn't be more wrong. He's a really multifaceted forward, does a lot of things really nicely.
He's so good.
But a lot of stuff goes through him. He's not just the exclamation point at the end of moves. He is a starting point too. And that's something I really didn't expect to see.
Whenever I watch them, the whole team just seems sort of more intelligent, faster and stronger than every other team. I know that's not actually true, but there's something about the way that they play that makes me feel that way.
Well, it might be a little bit to do with then you. So every time you watch them, you're kind of learning. But I still think I'd agree. Like I think some of that is new division enthusiasm. And so I'd be interested, not knocking what they've achieved so far, I think they've been great, but I'd be interested to see what kind of tone of performance they're giving in November and December.
Well, indeed, they are this year's Leeds, right?
Yeah, let's see where they are. I mean, hopefully, be proved wrong, they keep proving us wrong, you know, month after month. But they've been fun, haven't they? They've been
Lots
different.
Fun.
They're very direct, very vertical. Yeah, that's kind of what works for them. Mm. And because you have players like Tony and Mbeumo who can link up with each other, it works quite well. You saw that one of the goals, I think, was it a goal? I can't remember if it was, but Liverpool, you know they're going to play a high line and push up. So the ball went back to the keeper who just knocked it like straight over the top and they were in behind.
Smart.
Yeah, smart.
It's little things so obvious. You see, like, it's oddly satisfying to see something happen in a game where you think, yeah, that's just analysis. Someone's been watching what you should do there, because it's actually amazing how rarely that seems to happen at other clubs.
The other thing they were doing in this game as well is something that I think noticed Aston Villa doing last season. Dean Smith said that they noticed with Liverpool, because they defend in that, they get into their deep block when they're being pushed right back. And you see everyone come back, even Salah comes back to help out in this deep block. And so the space is either side of that block, so they just keep switching it around. Remember when Villa did them, like 8-2 or something, whatever they came out to score was?
Yeah.
It was just for them switching play all the time. So a free kick. So one of the free kicks he scored was a lovely little move where it was a short pass inside to then go out to a run which started to be just in line with the back line on the wing. And then that ball went in from there because they then earned the space, because that was the way they'd worked it. It's really clever. And it's to do with like pulling Liverpool one side, leaving the space on the other side. I think Match did analysis of it as well and pointed out how they constantly overloaded the far side with maybe three or four players always in that far post.
All on Trent as well, mostly.
Yeah, because then, yeah.
Which was the goal where he was left with a 3-on-1?
That was
the second goal?
That was the second goal, yeah. I think the point is that happens several times throughout the game, yeah.
Yeah.
It's very clever.
And then it's overloading that side, but it's also about shifting the ball constantly around, so you always have that. And that's it's obviously been they've done a lot of analysis before that game to play in that certain way, and it's worked, so it looks like the guy's a genius now. Mm.
Well, my favourite thing about the game, and indeed the weekend, was the little look that Thomas Frank and Jurgen Klopp shared at 3-3. There was a chance. I can't remember which team nearly scored a fourth, but one of them did, and they shared a little face, and I thought, oh, that was nice. A little moment of human interaction with a face there, a face that you wouldn't normally see, you know, a facial expression that you wouldn't normally...
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Catch all new episodes Thursdays on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Chelsea 0, 1 Manchester City. Now, JJ, the first question, we made a video about this at the weekend, but would you reprise to me briefly how Guardiola managed to get City to unlock Chelsea? Because they're a notoriously tough defence to break down. They did it here.
They kept them pinned in. So they didn't let them. It's not so much they unlocked them, they just overwhelmed them. They outnumbered right. them. They pressured with a high, like four or five people. Yeah, they squashed them like a bug. And they did that from the start. Very aggressive, determined, like clearly highly organised press. So it wasn't, I don't think it was man to man, but it was just everyone was squeezing up to try and get to stop Chelsea being able to play out. Mm. And when they can't play out, they've got to play it long. And then you've got Werner, who's getting useful, goes over the top, but City then just retreated a couple of yards and cleared that up easily. And Lukaku, whose link-up play wasn't amazing. He got better later on in the game, I think, actually. Started to hold up himself a bit better and be able to roll defenders. But that was their out, was those two forwards who just couldn't get into the game whatsoever. Changed the shape in the second half. He took Conte off and took on Kai Havertz, who scored the goal in the Champions League final. And then Havertz meant they had a front three, which means they could press in a different way, and they were suddenly able to get out, and Havertz was helping link that play there.
Why didn't they start like that?
Because I think the new City would play a high line, so you've got Werner and Lukaku, who are both rapid.
Right. They thought that they could exploit that, and when it didn't work, that's when they changed.
I think that's what the plan was, yeah. And okay. You had Conte and Kovacic either side of Jorginho, who were helping to press with a forward four, because you knew City were going to play with either a four or a three at the back. Mm-hmm. So then you've got numbers that would be able to work with that. But because they're not the same line as the strikers, like Kovacic, for example, on the left, not the same line as the two forwards, it means it's slightly different the way the press works. So again, they couldn't do what they wanted to do. But it was not a million miles off what they did in the Champions League final. It just seems probably easier because it's less pressure, because it's not the biggest game of the year. Yeah. And it worked this time.
Okay. Seb, City obviously beat Chelsea doing this, but Tottenham and Villa both tried something not dissimilar in Chelsea's previous two games. Should Tuchel be concerned at all that maybe teams have cottoned on how to play against them now?
No, I think a bit too early to say that. Like, I feel like, agree with JJ, like, that was clearly the plan. I felt like Tuchel tinkered a little bit too much there. Like, I'm not sure. The Werner thing I don't get, and this was a conversation on German Sky about sort of Werner instead of Havertz, because Havertz does so many things really well. He's a problem in so many different ways. Like he's a big guy, he's good in the air, he's a goal threat, he's skillful, he's creative, he moves well between the lines. Like, Werner to me is much more one-dimensional, and so if I wanted to occupy City defenders and defensive midfielders, Havertz is my guy.
Havertz is also faster.
I don't know about that.
No, I mean, his top speed is recorded as faster.
Okay, well,
I'm pretty sure, or at least he was the fastest player in the Bundesliga the season he left.
Okay, I mean, sometimes
Werner wasn't there, was he?
I remember Antonio Valencia once being the quickest player in the Premier League a couple of years ago, which surprised me. I don't quite trust it.
It's the space ahead of them, isn't it?
Yeah. So
when it's a striker, you know that they... Anyway, go on.
I also think Havertz is just a better player.
Sure.
A much better player, sure. A much more complete player. And if I was a City player that turned up at Stamford Bridge and I saw him not in the team, that would make me happy. So I get it. I just think that it's not time for Chelsea to worry. It's just one of those things where maybe an instance where maybe Thomas Tuchel had too many options, too many attacking options at least, and sort of outthought himself a little bit.
JJ, Grealish has really started to settle in now at Manchester City, hasn't he? Although one thing I will say, he doesn't look good in that shirt colour. I really don't think he looks right in it. Not as in he's not a good, he shouldn't play for Manchester City. There's just something about him and the colour of the shirt. I just don't like it.
I'm sorry you don't like it.
Well, thank you.
Fine. So, yes, that's done now.
That's done.
Grealish, I thought he settled in immediately at City.
Did you?
Yeah, I thought he was decent, yeah.
Okay.
I think he's probably got better as he's learned who his friends are in the team and all the different bits of the structure he's supposed to do.
Settling in.
I think it's weird how he doesn't... I can't tell if he's that fast or not, but it seems that no one seems to be able to tackle him.
Yeah.
It's odd.
He's gluey.
Yeah, it's weird. Yeah. So I think he's done really well. He's created a lot of chances for them, like goal-creating actions, a lot of that stuff going on with Grealish. But he's a very good player and he's really expensive.
Sure.
And so regardless of how he looks in the shirt, I think he's done well.
Well, Seb, it feels a lot like this is a good Premier League season, right? The title race is quite unclear 6 games in. I feel like half the seasons in the last 10 years have not been decided after 6 games, but it's been at least very clear if it's a 1-horse race or if it's a 2-horse race. I feel like we have a sort of 3-horse race here, maybe a 4-horse race.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Because one thing we didn't say about Liverpool when we were talking about them is that they finished the weekend top of the league. Yeah. They haven't sort of startled or amazed as of yet, but they're very clearly in the race as a horse.
Very much so. They are a horse in the race.
Yes.
They have left the stalls and they are racing.
Yeah.
What I would also say is good Premier League season because there are lots of interesting subplots. So beyond the title, which is what it is, there are lots of teams that I want to watch. We talked about Villa earlier, but Brighton are going to Palace tonight. We're recording this on Monday. Looking forward to that because I'm really enjoying watching Brighton. West Ham are an interesting watch.
Sure.
Still a little bit of a riddle. Something slightly off with West Ham.
They beat Leeds 2-1, of course.
They did. There's a settling in. There's still a few issues in the defence, which I'm sure will improve once Kurt Zouma settles in there.
Everton doing weirdly well.
Everton are like defeating their own narrative.
They're fifth right now on 13 points, 1 point behind Liverpool, matched with City, Chelsea and United, who are the other three of the new big four.
Feels very fresh, doesn't it? It feels like there's a little bit of something for everybody.
I feel refreshed.
You do. That's good.
Yeah. Okay. Well, fine. Fine. That was most of the things we wanted to talk about. Of course, Everton beat Norwich 2-0. At the weekend, Leicester and Burnley with a draw as well. We haven't really got time to talk about those. When will Norwich win a game? Goodness gracious me. I hope it's soon. But it probably won't be, you know, because they're not very good. But now let's talk about some other things which may or may not be very good. I don't know if they are or not. But you might know. Video games. Go.
The new Pro Evo is out soon.
E-football.
Correct.
Yeah.
Also, the new FIFA.
FIFA.
You've heard of that one before.
I've heard of both of them.
Yes, that's good.
Yeah.
Now, Seb and I were discussing this earlier, that football games aren't very fun anymore, and I don't know if these are going to be fun at all.
See, I'm in a weird position, because when I return to Germany, I've got some annual leave booked in, and in previous years, maybe quite a long time ago now, having 2 weeks off when the new Pro Evo launches is pretty ideal in terms of work planning and, you know, pushing out your holidays. And now I think, it might not bother.
Is that because Jaylen's busy playing it and she leaves you alone to read your old books?
No, Jaylen's more into Red Dead Redemption. We've had a, you know, Tomb Raider as well and Uncharted.
She's a masochist.
Yeah, no, she. But it's just not fun. Like, I don't find FIFA fun.
Exactly.
I find it like, I like realism. I like constructing things in a kind of master leaguey way. I like that. But FIFA is just, it just feels very much not for me. And I have no enthusiasm for it. When you look online, you know, all the sort of the skills videos and the kind of the, sort of cinematic goals that score, it just doesn't capture me.
I don't know.
Why can't it be fun? Why can't? Why yeah. cannot it? Why?
What is this segment? This segment is old men but railing. Railing something which literally isn't for them. But it's then, not made then, for you.
Yeah, but why can't a small aspect of it? Why is it inaccessible? There's plenty of young people things that I find fun.
Like what?
I liked Call of Duty. I'm not very good at it.
Well, that was just, it's not
Warzone that. Scares me, but. We've talked about that
sure.
in other times. But it's why can't it be... Computer games are so impressive in so many ways. There are so many amazing things happening. Why can you not make...
Yeah, spoken as a true person who lacks the understanding of how they're made.
Yeah, but why is it so difficult? Like 25 years ago, you were able to make fun football games. Sensible World of Soccer, excellent game. Original ISS, excellent game. Pro Evolution Soccer on the PlayStation 1, excellent game.
What do you think about music now? What do you think about anything from now?
I like some aspects of modern life.
This is the issue. What Seb hasn't realised is that the world, the consumers, you know, are marketed towards for teenagers. That's, you know, because they've got
yeah, but hopes and dreams are these teenagers? Everywhere I look, I see criticism of these games. Like, you don't see sort of unanimous praise from sort of, you know, the 15 to 25 year old demographic. You just see complaints. Like, the new Madden game was released, everyone hated it. Like, the new anything, but it's a fair criticism. It's not just an old man shouting.
I think a lot of people play these games now because they're supposed to, and they're kind of
there's no competition. There's nothing else. You play one of them. If you like football and you like video games, you probably play one of them.
They used to be fun.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you used to have fun?
No, they were good.
I think
they
were about...
They were addictive, like, in a good way. Now they're addictive in a way I don't like.
You know what I found strange? The eFootball thing. So I was on my Pro Evo over the weekend.
Ish.
And there's a new window which allows you to pre-order an aspect of it for £29.
That's a new window.
Like, it's just popped up. Like, with you know... Where it gives you your benefits, your, like, oh, here's my old player from Bayern Munich. Here's, you know, you collect Oliver Kahn. Okay. And now on this free to play game, I have now got the option to spend £29 on what? It just go to it. Anyone who's got the game, go to it. You'll find it. It's sort of spend £29 for this game, which has not been released and is for free and doesn't have any features, but spend some money. And it also says it's a loyalty bonus for me. What?
But then you get to play with Ronaldinho if you're lucky.
And I looked it up and I didn't really understand what it was, even after reading the description, but people said, oh yeah, this is for a feature that's released in November.
Well, I mean, when you book a holiday, do you buy it on the day when you arrive at the airport?
No.
Or do you buy it ahead of time?
But it's a free-to-play game.
When I book a holiday... Do you pay ahead because you know you're going to use that? What?
No, just make Pro Evo 4 again. That's all we need to say. Just make that again.
When I book my holiday, in return for my money, I get a flight, a stay, a different environment, perhaps some sun, sometimes even a beach.
This guy's always booking with the Thomas Cook. Or one of those other ones.
There's no holiday. It is charging me for the opportunity to go to my living room or something. I don't know. It's an illusory product.
This, I promise to the younger people listening, it's not all like this. Yeah, it's not just
getting
old
older is terrible. It's coming for you. You cannot escape
it's
it.
Not.
You can be young and cool now, but give it 5 years. Yeah.
40-year-old man, you know, thinks everything's supposed to be,
you know,
for
get
him.
Get fatter. You can't just, you know, you can't just eat what you want all the time. You lose your hair. The hair that doesn't fall out goes gray. It's coming for you. It's old age and it's horrible. And you enjoy stuff less. Your favorite things that you enjoyed become rubbish. That's how life is.
Yeah.
Look forward
Whoopee! To it. Anyway, that's the end of the TIFO Football Podcast.
Maybe
for a long time. No, we'll be back next week. Don't worry, Seb will have left the country again. So you won't have to be affronted with this horror. Thank you to Seb Stafford-Bloor.
Thank you, Joe Devine.
And thank you to JJ Bull.
Thank you.
The Bullard.
Yes.
Yes. Thanks, of course, as usual, to Don Maher over there in the corner. And to Adonis for all of the audio editing and production assistance that we get. And to you, dear listener and or viewer, for being with us for this time. We'll be back next week to talk about whatever the hell has happened then. And in the meantime, hope you have a lovely week. Ta-ra!
The Athletic.